In your mind's eye, I'd like for you to pause and take away everything you know about time and existence. I'd like for you to go to eternity. There's where our God dwells. He's called an everlasting Father. He's called an eternal God. He beckons us to come to eternity. Before there was a time, there was a God. And God, in his inimitable way, decided that he was going to create time, space, and matter. And as he stepped forth from eternity, he made space. There had never been space before. There had been nothing in space before, and so God put a single small globe there. He called it Earth. As he put this globe in this great space, it came into existence spinning and whirling. It was covered with water, and the Spirit of Jehovah walked upon the deep. Then God began his great creative power of making this globe that we live on a habitable place for us to live. Now, all the laws that we know that have been found by men, and many laws that are yet to be discovered, he put in place in that moment. He spoke it ex nihilo. He did not have to ask anyone else for favor or ability. He, by his own volition, said it would be, and that it was. If you read the Genesis account and find the 6 days there, you'll find the magnificence of our God making a place habitable for all the beasts of the field, all the denizens of the deep, and all the fowls of the sky. And yet he made it not for them, but for us. And when he had scooped the dust of the earth and had formed it into man, he breathed in the man the nostrils, the breath of life, and put in him a likeness unto he himself, God. And there was an inner man, and there was an outer man. And from that time on, man has lived in a resplendent world. Until you read in the book of Genesis in chapter 9, verse 6, and you find that every imagination of man was continually evil, and repented God that he had made man. And only one man of all the men upon the face of the earth found favor with God. His name was Noah. And he told Noah that his spirit would not always strive with man, and gave him a special period of time in which to build an ark, upon which he would save himself and all the animals that God would place into the ark. The great rage of that great flood and all the things that happened, you need to, for a moment, ponder. For he opened the fountains of the deep, the volcanic eruptions, the eruptions of the water. The waters above came down upon the earth, and it said that the waters covered all the great mountains. And the ark floated on the face of the water. God remembered Noah and made the ark to rest upon the top of a mount called Mount Ararat. And from that time on, God made a pledge. I will never destroy the earth with water again. In fact, the pledge was that I'll put a bow in the sky to prove to you that I'll never do it. But there was a contingent thing that God had in mind. Although he will never destroy by water, God is coming. The next time he'll come with fire. And it'll destroy all the things upon this earth. Now, following that, there's a period of time that we know the names, we know the countries, we know the places and the circumstances of the patriarchs, one of which was Job. We know that after Noah came off the ark, Noah had a time to expand his family, expand his people. They should have gone into all the world, but they didn't. In a vainglorious way, they decided to build a tower They were going to show God how great they were. Not that they could ever reach God, but to show them that they didn't need God. And so God came down and smote them, that their language was so diverse that they could not speak to each other. And so they were scattered in the far-flung corners of the world. Job became some of those, one of those, that was in the far-flung corners of the world. He was a righteous man. We know that righteousness only comes because men hear God, believe God, and honor God. We know several things about Job that I'd like for you to think about. Men have attacked the book of Job. They've made it mythology. They've made it legends. They've made it oral things. And they've attacked it on every standpoint. But you have to understand that if that be so, then you're going to have to take at least 13 books out of the New Testament. For the book of Romans, Paul will quote Job, not once, not twice, but three times, and tell us about the wisdom of Job. Or in the book of 1 Corinthians, the third chapter, verse 19, he says the same thing. He said, there was a man, Job, and I'll quote from him. Or can we say, James, who was a brother of our Lord, said, do you know the patience of Job? You'd have to take the major part of the New Testament away if Job was not a real man. Job also proves to us there is a real Satan. When we read about him, oftentimes we simply see him attacking the Lord. The book of Matthew, the fourth chapter. Or sifting Peter. Or things like that. Oh, we read the book of Revelations. How he's a great dragon and all those things. But Satan's real. There was a time when he could go to the very presence of God and ask for a man to test him. What kind of being is he? A roaring lion? One that has fiery darts? One that has snares? And one that you and I understand that his equal is not upon this earth? His equal is in the heavenly abode and sits by the right hand of the Father. And even greater than that, he is God. And he will judge that devil in the final day. God does not apologize to Job for his human suffering. In the 38th chapter, instead of saying, I'm sorry that you went through this, I'm sorry you had your great difficulties, I'm sorry Satan came upon you, he just simply said, you asked for me. In the 13th chapter, he said, I wish I could talk to God, and now God is going to talk to him. And God is going to ask him such succinct questions that the questions become so important we need to ask every agnostic, every atheist, and every scientist who does not believe in God these same questions. For in this you'll find that the answer will either be only God knows, or only God is the answer. He starts off by saying to him, I want you to gird up your loins. You come in these words, and now I want to ask you. I want to ask you about the foundation of the earth. I want you to explain to me how that earth was in space and how it stayed there in space without anything else. Oh, we talk about the sun, the moon, the stars, and all the things out there, and how there's attraction and repulsion, how there's all kinds of gravitational pulls and such like that. This was not there. How did I do that? How did I set the foundation of this, the world that you live on? Was it a man named Atlas, a god of the Greeks, that held it upon his shoulder? Or was it my mind and my power that brought this into existence and therefore sustained it by my word? And Job is going to learn providence. He's already seen the power of God, and now he'll say, how did you do that? You'll find that he'll ask some questions like, do you know how to measure the earth? He had all the mountains on one side and all the seas on the other side. It would go flip-flop, flip-flop through space. But it's so unique that it spins in space. At one time it was vertical. Now it sets at 23.5 degrees off-center. You might note that at both poles there is ice there. You might also know that our earth wobbles like a great ice cream freezer. There was a time after the great flood, that they have believed that during the days of Peleg that there was an ice age. There's evidence of it. Great glaciers came from the north to the areas just above the equator. What caused that? Why did they regress? Let me tell you something. It's not the SUV that you're driving. It's not the fossil fuel that you're using that destroys our earth. The earth is being destroyed in exactly the same way that it was in the day of Noah, by sin. And sin is the most dreadful thing in all the world. In this text, you'll find that he wants to know where was the cornerstone. Or have you ever been to Arizona? Or perhaps you've been to New Mexico? Have you seen those big dishes that they have in the desert out there? That they haunt the sky. They listen to the stars as they sing. They wonder, where are these at? Who is out there? And they create all kinds of mythological things out there. They say there's a man on Mars. You recall that years ago there was a fellow that went to the South Pole and he found a rock. He came back and he said, I found a rock from Mars. And everybody just rejoiced in it. I just couldn't believe that they found a rock from Mars. And my question was, how did he know? Was he on Mars to find a rock like that rock? Had he ever walked the landscape? The answer is no. From his fertile imagination, he drew a conclusion that's false. He didn't know that and will never know that. Until they walk upon Mars and say, this is that, and I'll still doubt that. And so we need to see that the stars sing, they make noise, but there's no one out there to answer our cry, who are you? Where are you? Because if it's true that man is unique, if it's true that man has the image of God in him, if it's true that Jesus Christ came to save man, if it's true that he only died once and he'll never die again, then no one else can be saved, no matter who he is in the universe, without Jesus. That makes our God capricious. And I think that's a lie. I believe our God is a great God. I believe this is the only place where mankind can, will, and shall survive upon this great universe. But he asked a question. When I lived in Rockport years ago, several years they had hurricanes that came through there. I lived in a stilt house, and right outside the back door of our house was a well. We drilled it down 50 feet, fresh water. And as the rage of the storms would come, as the sea would rise, as all this would happen, something happened. The well was never polluted with salt water. How did God stop the seawater from commingling with the fresh water? He asked the question right here in verse 8. How did I shut up the sea? And Job cannot answer that. In fact, no scientist on the face of the earth today can answer. Oh, they can tell us about how the granules of this salt is there and how the granules of the sand is there and all these things. They explain all this way. But you ask the question, how did it get there? Who put it there around the coastlines of all the continents of all the world? And why is not the water polluted by that? So I think we need to ask questions that God asked Job. It goes on. Have you ever watched the astronauts as they float through space? They look down upon the earth. Have you ever noticed what's there? A swaddling band of clouds. Now you may know this. That there's a great deal of water upon earth. In fact, 3/4 of our earth is covered with water. But only 3% of that water is palatable to us. And that water is replenished over and over again, and only 3% stays usable for mankind. No matter how he stores it, no matter where he stores it, no matter how big the dams he may build, and such as that, there's only 3%. And no wonder we fight for water. But how does it come to pass? Why do the clouds rise out of the sea? Why do they rise up and float over the land? Why do they do this and do that? And the question is, I don't know. Even though they're hydrologists, men that study this all the time, they cannot explain why or how. It's just a phenomena that they can tell you that it happens. I watch the news, and I watch the prognosticators. That's a near liar, by the way, who tell us about the weather. Have you ever seen them do the things that they do, the gyrations they go through? Verse 12 of the 38th chapter. He wants to know something. He said, were you there when I started day? Were you there when I made the first rays of the sun to go across the earth? Can you stop the sun? Well, in that very text, he's going to ask the question about withholding light. Do you recall in the book of Exodus chapter 10 that Israelite was in bondage? And God, in one of his great curses upon Pharaoh and upon the Egyptians, was to withhold the light from them. But there was light in the house of Israel. Now, there's a phenomenon that you may know about. It's a luminiferous kind of a material. It has helium in it. And if that does not exist, there is no light. There can be fire, but it does not give off light without that. How does God do these things? The answer is that God can perform marvelous things by the word of his power. And that's what I want you to get out of Job. I want you to understand that God is asking questions that need to be asked in our own day and time. We need to understand about the springs of the sea. Brother Moore brought that up. It's a wonderful thing. Do you realize that in the seas there are great springs of water, fresh water? And as they gurgle up, they make huge mounds and they replenish the bottom of the deep. And yet, when you're there, that water stays without salt in it for some time and then finally goes off into the salt sea and becomes amalgamated therein. Those fountains are everywhere. Did you know it wasn't until the 1800s A.D. that they knew that? When a ship called the Challenger in that time sailed the seas, they were able to discover some of these things. And so as you read these things, you need to say, I see that. But then suddenly he said, let me ask you a question, Job. Do you know the gates of death? Do you know how a man dies? And everyone probably has gone through that phenomena or has watched something about the phenomena, and they know that the eyes close and the organs shut down and death occurs. But what happens to the soul? What happens to the inner being? Recall Elijah. The widow he was staying with, her son died, and he went once, twice, thrice, and it said the spirit returned to that one. Or recall in the book of John, the 11th chapter, that Jesus stood without and beckoned his friend to come. One of the things I find so ironic is that Jesus wept on that occasion. You know why he wept? He wept because the man was going to come forth. No, not at all. He wept because when he came forth, he was going to be tested and tried again by the Pharisees. They were going to try to take his life. He knew what he was going to go through. And so as he came forth, it proved that Jesus was the resurrection. But it also proved that Lazarus was a righteous and faithful man until death. In this text, it goes on. It said, do you understand the earth? The great dimensions of it. You know, the sun is about 96 million miles away from us. If we were 10 degrees closer, we would burn up. If we were 10 degrees further, they'd call us Pluto, the planet of ice. How does this happen that it always stays just like that? How about the moon circling us? You realize that as the moon goes past on one side of the earth, it causes the oceans to rise, and the other side, it shrinks like a dimple. And as it goes on around, it makes that rise, and this going like a dimple. We have the tide because of that. What causes that? Oh, we say gravitation, but what causes it? What causes our earth to have this repulsion, contractions, expulsion, and such as that? And so when he asks these great questions, he says, verse 21, let me ask you about age. I get tickled at these kind of things because there's every kind of medication in the world to keep you alive. The oldest man that we know of, and he may not have been the oldest at all, 969 years was his life, Methuselah. His name was When He Dies, It Comes, which was talking about the flood. But there are others that lived equally close to that time. And no man today lives much more than 100 years. And they do have the aches and pains and such as that. What happened that men began to diminish after the flood? Did things change? And obviously, you realize that they really changed. And the change was that even though we lived in this resplendent world before, and it was crushed by men's sin, God still in His great inimitable power can sustain you. When you read the book of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, when you read about all the seasons of life, guess who puts them there? Guess who sustains them there? Guess who gives those? You ask a scientist, or ask the agnostic, or ask the philosopher that does not believe in God these questions, and he'll put his hand over his mouth and say, I do not know. We'll answer. Either God is the answer, or God has the answers. And that's Job. That's his book. And so God didn't explain to Job these things. He just asked him some questions. How about rain? Years ago when I was growing up, we lived in northern New Mexico, and we were in a very harsh time. The rains had not come. And so they hired a rainmaker. Have you ever seen a rainmaker? I mean, he came out there with his rockets and all these kind of things, and he was going to send up these things in the sky, and as the cloud went by, it was going to boom into him, and the rain would come tumbling down. He left just before they tarred and feathered him. How did Elijah cry out unto God, and it did not rain for 3.5 years, and then he bent his knee before his God, and he said, I see a cloud like a fist. And he told Ahab, you better get off this mountain, because it's going to rain. And as you read these things, I want you to kind of go away with the idea that there's things like frost, snow, ice, hail, things like that. Where do they come from? Have you ever seen hoary frost? Hoary frost is such a fragile thing. It's the wind blowing with just a slight bit of moisture. And it just adds up and it just sticks out like great stickers. He said, where does that come from? Where does the ice come from? Where does the rain come from? Why is hail as it is? Not long ago, we had small little hailstones in our area, while north of us, they had them the size of baseballs. What causes lightning? Why do the clouds part? And one becomes polarized positive, and one becomes negative, and lightning flashes between it. Oh, they'll explain it, but they don't explain it. They'll take you to a science class in a college, and they'll explain it away. I'm going to say that God put all these laws in play when He spoke the world into existence. And man is just fortunate enough to find some of them out. He hasn't even got to the very big part of God's laws. I'm still in the same text. Look at verse 31. He said, I want you to ask a question. I want you to answer this question. I want you to talk about the Pleiades and the Orion. Now, when you see these, you probably, if you've studied anything about the stars, you know that the Pleiades is going to be the springtime stars. And it looks like there's about 6 stars together. And when you look at it through the Great Telescope Tower, you'll find that there's a great band of stars out there, and they're disassociated. It seems like they're random. But God said they were really clustered. How did that happen? Or could you go to the other one? That is also a constellation that comes up in the fall of the year. And these two things signify the change of the seasons. How does God do that? Oh, I know. He gave a man a stick and let him stir the stars. He gave him a fulcrum that he might move the stars. He gave him a breath enough to blow them away or to put one out. We see the supernovas and such things like that, and we're stars bound by it. We just are saying how great it is and what makes them explode. Oh, I know. It was the Big Bang. Do you know that thing's fallen on hard times? I wonder why. When you start with a lie, you end with a lie. When you start with God, He never lies. He always tells the truth. In the story that we're looking at, He's going to ask about the constellations, the signs of the zodiac. Let's go over to 39 for a minute, and chapter 38, verse 39. Let's talk about lions. You know, have you ever watched the History Channel or the Discovery Channel, and you see this great pride of lions? And when you look at it, you see that there's no real lion there. The guy with the big mane that makes the big roar like that, he's off someplace else. Guess who is the greatest huntress among the lions? He said, do you know the lioness and how she takes care of the appetites of her young? Do you know how that happens? How about a raven? You know, a raven is an unclean bird. And I was always surprised that God used an unclean bird to feed the prophet Elijah, but He did. He brought him meat and bread. He wants to know, how about the raven? How does he take care of his young? Who gave him the instincts to do this? He'll mention this in a few moments in chapter 39, verse 13, the ostrich. Just the exact difference. She'll step on her eggs and be ruthless to her children. Why are they so different? And we'll say, well, it's instinct. And we talk about the migrating birds, how they go all the way to South America. The little tiny hummingbird can fly such great distances across great oceans. And they'll say, we know how. They've got an instinct. I want to know where that came from. I want to know who put it in them that they'll always do it. One time, I watched a bird build a nest. And it was just kind of thrown together. And some feathers put in it. I thought, until one day I saw an Oreo. Have you ever seen one of those that build those nests that hang down like this? It's consistent every single time. Every generation does it. And what they do, they've got a school for those birds. They go to it and they study how to build nests. You don't believe that. I know I'm making fun of them, but sometimes we need to get really serious about the matter and ask them the hard question like God asked Job. You give me an answer. Gird up the loins of your mind. You tell me. Don't just guess at it. Don't just give us something that you thought up. Really tell us what the law is. Why is this there? And the answer is, I don't know why it's there. I just know it's there. And I'm going to say either God knows the answer or God is the answer. In this same text, in the 39th chapter, he talks about the wild ass, about the horse. But one of the things in verse 26 is the hawk and his eye. Now, there's a law that they've discovered. There are some things that you can only reduce down to a certain level. It's called irreducible, and that's the eye. Now, if I plucked my eye out like this and held it up like this, you'd see what it's made of. You see how unique it is, how it's attached to my brain because I couldn't pull it very far out. But you just also see the socket that's there, the moisture there, the tear ducts there, the eyelashes, and all of that. And without all that being there, you have no eye. How did that happen? It couldn't happen by evolution, as they say, because it's reduced down to where all these things have to be in place for it to be there. What gave this great hawk this great ability to scan 10,000 feet in the air and look at a field mice in the field below? Can you do that? When I was young, I thought I had good eyes. Never that eye. So when you ask these questions, you get down to the point that you say, I need to know. Let's go to chapter 40 for just a minute. I know I'm going in someone else's territory, but I looked at the book and he didn't touch it, so I'm going to. Let's talk about the behemoth. Now, maybe in the side of your Bible there, you've got it where it says he's a hippopotamus. But I want you to read that. And then I want you to go to your car. And I want you to ride on a counter to someplace. I'm going to take a vacation and go to Glen Rose, Texas. And I'm going to go there to the Creation Research Museum. And I'm going to walk in there and they'll show me a footprint of a dinosaur. And in one of the footprints of the dinosaur, a man has stepped in it. And a few feet further, the dinosaur stepped on a man's footprint. I'm going to tell you that men lived with the dinosaurs. Now, the truth is, God's going to say, you go look at this one. So either God was a liar, or the scientists that deny that men live with the dinosaurs are the liars. And I choose the latter. I want to tell you that men walk with dinosaurs. And it says, I want you to go look at this behemoth. I want you to see what he is. He is a huge thing. His tail is like a cedar, not like a little short tail on a hippopotamus. When it moves everything its way. He's the chief of all the dinosaurs. I've seen some in the natural museums around the world. And they're mammoth. And when you stand beside a mastodon and you only come up to his knuckles, you say, he's big. But he wasn't big at all. Some of those things are 50 tons. Hippopotamus maybe 4 or 5 tons. And so he said, I want you to see him. He has to have a whole mountain to feed him. When the river rises like the Jordan, he has no fear. He just and swallows it up. What kind of beast is this that walk with mankind? And God said, I created him. Now, there are many reasons for the dinosaurs to die, and we'll go into that another time, but they're all gone. But you need to go to Montana, to the mountains up there where they have mountains of dinosaur bones. I fished just the other day in a creek over by Roanoke. As I walked across there, here's a great layer of all kinds of shells and all kinds of vertebrae, and all kinds of jawbones, and all kinds of ribbons of dinosaurs are right there in Roanoke, just 20 miles from where I live. And yet it's all around the world. Do you realize if you went to the top of Mount Everest and drilled down, you would find the shells of fish from the bottom of the sea. How deep was the ocean? Or better yet, what pushed that mountain up? What about the tectonic plates and all of that? You know, years ago I was in Switzerland and I didn't know what I was looking at when I looked at it. But there are huge mountains over there. One of those is Mount Everest. Just a few miles from Mount Everest, there's a range of mountains that go all the way down into middle of Europe and cross over into France and go down into Spain. And on the side of one of those is a lake standing vertical. On the top part of this lake, which is standing vertical now, are the remains of a village where they had still houses, where they once fished in the marsh. You know that the Rocky Mountains haven't always been here. You know also, if you go to the Pacific Ocean, there's a huge rift out there that is 7 miles deep. Do you realize that you could put Mount Everest in that rift and have 6,000 feet on top of it of water? And when you read these things, you just simply say, what are these? What is happening? There are mammoth beasts that live, chapter 41. There's one called the Leviathan, and in your border you'll probably see crocodile. But I want you to read that text when you have time. It asks you a question, can you rope his mouth? Can you really make him speak, and can you speak to him in soft terms? And can you really bind him? Can you really make him do what you want? Can a fisherman go out and catch him and bring him in and sell him as a ware? Can he traffic in him? He asks, can someone with a spear go out and capture him? Can any of these things happen? And the fact is that in verse 10 it says, you better not stir that one up. If that behemoth was the largest land animal, this is the largest aquatic animal known to man. When you read this, it talks about his great frame. It talks about his great jaw. It talks about his great face. But something happens in this. And in verse 17 and 18, you need to read what it says. It says, when he sneezes, flame comes flashing from his nostrils. And they've always come to this and say, aha, that's a legend, that's a myth, that's a lie. And I'll talk to you about the bombardier beetle that can do the same thing. He couldn't evolve like that because, you see, on each side of the back end of him, there are two cylinders. And they're filled with the elements that must be spurted by him at the exact moment when he clicks his feet together and a flame will go poof from it. Or could I talk to you about the electric eel? Or could I talk to you about the fish that have eyes that glow? And that's been proven by those that know anything about dinosaurs that on certain dinosaurs there's a cavity near the eyes. And as they were herbivorous, and as they drew this in, and this stayed there, it created a methane gas. Well, if that's not so, then the next thing he says about that flame is it lights coals. It set things on fire. Either our God lied to Job, or there was a real animal like that. You know, around the world, there's all kinds of legends, lore. In fact, if you go to China, they've got dragons that they go down the street blowing fire. So what I want you to see is that God said, I did all this. I will continue to do all these things. I hold the laws in my mind. I hold the laws of my power. And so people have said, well, look how Job suffered and how God didn't apologize to him. Let me tell you something. God didn't need to, because God is going to give to Job great wealth and great power. But we don't need to rejoice in that. That's not the end of the story. Because the end of the story is when he dies in a righteous way, God always has something to say to the righteous. Well done, thou good and faithful. And after all, that's all God has to say. We can go through manifold trials, manifold tribulations, all those great things that we talked about. And yet when we need to really get down to it, we have to ask ourselves, do we really trust in that God? Do we really have confidence in that God? Will he really raise me from the dead? Will he really take me home? Will I really have a mansion? Will I really have white robes? Will I really live with God and the Son and the Holy Spirit and all the angelic beings and all the holy men that have been made justified by the blood of the Lamb? And I'm going to say, God said it. I believe it. And that's the end of the matter. And that's what Job is all about. You endure. When times get tough, and the rope gets thin, tie a knot in it and just hang on. Because at the end of the rope, there awaits you a heavenly abode. But you must be prepared for that place. Job did it. He lived godly and righteously even through the trials. And so we, the brethren, need to understand that God cries out unto us through his word. Will you understand that I will be with you until the end of the world? Will you understand that I will be with you through trials and tribulation? Will you understand that I'll bless you and honor you and care for you and keep you, even though you may die in my service? There's a home that is a place of rest for you, and your works will follow after you. And so the question would be, are you living like that, my brethren? If God called you home tonight, what would he say to you? Would he say, because of what you have done, who you've been, the life you've lived, the faithfulness shown, well done, good and faithful servant? Or is there a torment in your heart? Greater than persecution, greater than trials? Is there a torment there that I really haven't lived up to the standards? I really haven't lived the life. I've been a sham. I've been disregarding. I've been veneer. Wouldn't it be the time to make it right tonight? To ask God to help you? At the same time, we love one and all. The Lord came to seek and save the lost. Maybe you're lost. I was once a sinner. I hated that term. Do you? I didn't like people to tell me that I was, but I was. I recall the night I came down and sat on the front pew and asked them to baptize me in the Lord Jesus Christ. An old elder asked me after I went back in the back. He said, "Do you know what you're doing?" Scared me to death. I said, "Yes, sir. What are you doing?" I said, "I'm repenting of the sins of my life." He said, "Did you confess Jesus Christ, the Son of God?" I said, "Yes, sir." Brother Miller took my confession. "What are you being baptized for?" I said, "For the remission of sins, to be added to Jesus Christ and the church which he died." And they patted me on the back and hugged me big, and I went to the baptistry and came out a Christian. Maybe you need to do the same. Maybe you're looking for a congregation to work and worship with. Wouldn't this be the one that you want to place your fellowship with? Yield your talents to them. Work and serve. Make it even greater than it is. Let's stand. Let's sing. Won't you come?